I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker, speaking on his story, steps 1 to 12, Adam from Harrison, New Jersey.
Hi, everybody. My name is Adam Andrick. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Very interesting week this week. I don't know. Last week, I thought I was fine. I thought everything was cool, you know. Everything's going smooth. Work is going good. All my relationships seem to be doing well. And a really weird thought came Friday, but it went away. And I went into a meeting and it went away. I woke up Saturday morning, stark raving insane, you know. And I did what I needed to do that day, you know. And I that afternoon I went and spoke to some friends I have. And I started to write some inventory on it. And what I had realized that I had been slacking off on my inventory, which I kind of knew. You know, I knew it because I hadn't written anything, you know, but I didn't realize the consequences of that, you know, at the time I was doing it. Somebody, J-Mo, said a line recently to me, and it sticks with me all the time now, and it's being powerless over alcohol is not my problem. My problem is my addiction to self-will, you know, and it slammed me right between the eyes, you know, because that's me, you know. Alcohol had, you know, the problem with alcohol has been removed. The 10-step promises have come true in my life. I've ceased fighting everything and everyone, even alcohol. You know, I've been restored to sanity. I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. But you know what? I ain't well. you know, that area of my life is okay. It's great. You know, it's not an issue. That's not to say that it couldn't become one someday, you know, tonight, tomorrow, whenever. But, you know, the everyday problems in my recovery are really not alcohol related. But that's just where I'm at today. You know, I find that if I have to speak, get current first. You know, I'm the oldest of three boys. I'm a byproduct of the '60s. My father's only 20 years older than me. I was born in 1969. I lived in a teepee. I lived on a commune. I lived in the back of a school bus. You know, I got pictures of me when I was 5 years old with blonde hair down to the middle of my back running around butt naked. You know, my mom seemed fit to show every girlfriend that I've ever brought home. You know, being a small child in my house was awesome. You know, it was a lot of fun because my parents were kids. You know, they knew how to relate to kids, you know. It was normal in my household to party, you know. It was acceptable, you know. It was the '70s, you know. You know, living in Northern California, you know. You know, it's probably the only time I'll say this throughout the whole pitch, but I drank with my father and I smoked pot with my mother. You know, that's my only drug reference, but that just shows you where I came from, you know. And my mom is in the, she's in the rooms today. My father belongs in some kind of fellowship, you know, probably Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, but I can't really, you know, he doesn't think he has a problem, you know. He lives under a bridge somewhere in Alaska, you know, or Hawaii or California, wherever he is at this time of year, I don't know. And he believes he's reliving his childhood and he's having a good time, you know, so whatever. none of this has anything to do with me being an alcoholic. You know, this stuff may have contributed to my unmanageability, my inability to function in life, you know, and have healthy relationships and get a job and pay bills and, you know, and all this stuff. But it really has nothing to do with my alcoholism. You know, yeah, they taught me a lot of things, but you know what? I'm an alcoholic because when I put booze in my system, I can't guarantee when I'm going to stop. You know, I may be able to go out and have two drinks. I've done it, you know. But then I can go out and say I'm going to have two drinks and drink 30. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. Damn. Earlier this evening, I thought of a great story from my past related to craving, and it just, like, flew out of my head, you know. But whatever. Oh, here it is. Okay. It flew back in. Yeah. I was about, I guess, 19 years old. And at this point in my life and my drinking career, I thought it more more efficient to live on the streets, you know. It was much easier to drink the way that I drank and do the things that I liked to do if I didn't have a house to go to, you know, that I didn't have to pay bills and waste my money on, you know, normal society-oriented stuff. So I go out this one night, or this one afternoon, actually, and start drinking. You know, by that night, I hit the bar, I bump into my dad, you know, we have a couple drinks together, I hit another place that I liked. I ended up eventually at this keg party. And I grew up in a college town, so it was normal just to walk into a stranger's house, pay $2 and get a cup, you know. It wasn't that strange. I end up at this keg party, I don't know anybody there. And the last thing I really remember, I was sitting at a table doing playing quarters for tequila. And I remember briefly wandering into the backyard towards my bicycle. I thought that if I rode a bike, I wouldn't get a DWI. So I rode a bike. I never got my license until I was like 25. But I got on my bike, and that was the last thing I remember. I wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning in the drunk tank. Okay. And they made me blow into the tube to see if they could release me, because you got to be legal limit before they release you. And I blew a .20 at 7 in the morning. They kept me for another couple hours or whatever until that wore down and I got to .10 or whatever the legal limit was at the time. And they released me. The first thing that crossed my mind when I hit the sunlight was, where's my bottle? That was the first thing that hit my mind. I stuck my thumb out. I'm 40 miles from my house out at the county jail. Stuck my thumb out. I hitchhiked home, and I hit that bottle. First thing, without question. That's the way I drink, you know. When booze is in my system, it does to me. I don't choose it. I don't decide when I'm going to drink. It takes over, you know. The mental obsession, on the other hand, is a little more wacky for me, you know. Living on the streets, I did a lot of things that you probably shouldn't do. And one of those things landed me in state prison for about 2 years. And the entire time that I was locked up, I wrote letters to rehabs, to judges, to lawyers, to my girlfriend, to anybody who would listen. You know, I got a problem with alcohol. I got a problem with drugs here. I need to go to a rehab. You know, I said it in court. You know, don't send me away. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a criminal. You know, I got busted, you know, for my own stuff. You know, it was my own personal use. It wasn't because I was this, you know, hardened criminal or whatever. For 19 months, I'm locked up. I'm writing letters constantly. I was released, and within 20 minutes, I had a six-pack. Within 2 hours, I was exactly where I was when I got locked up. And that night, I slept under a bridge. Now, what does it say? That we can't remember the pain and humiliation of even a week or a month ago? Well, I just got locked up. You know, I just got released 20 minutes ago. And I forgot. You know, that's the way my brain works. You know, it's not... It says it in the literature, you know, we don't have the same defense from keeping our hands off a hot stove. You know, that's me. That's the way I relate to alcohol. My favorite, one of my favorite speakers, Earl H., always says that, oh God, brain fart again. Oh, geez. Oh, forget it. It wasn't that important then. I'm trying to steal a quote. Well, back to where I was. Okay. I picked up my first drink when I was about 13 years old. Well, my first conscious drink to go out and party with my friends. I had many a drink before that. You know, my dad gave me beer in my bottle and watched me stumble around and everybody thought it was funny. But my first conscious drink was at 13. And I blacked out that night. We got a gallon of wine and five beers. And I drank all five beers and as much of the wine as I could. You know, nobody wanted to drink the beers. They said it tasted like crap. And I was like, so? Yeah. I'm not drinking for taste. I don't drink for taste. I drink for effect. I blacked out that night. I woke up with the most wickedest hangover you could imagine in a puddle of red wine and Doritos. And my first thought was, wow, I can't wait till next week. I had to move at that point. That week, Wednesday, I moved. And so I didn't get the opportunity to drink the next week because when I moved to this new town, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know how to get it. I'm 13 years old, you know. But as soon as I found it, I drank again. By the time I turned 15 or 16 or whatever it was, I had made my way back to California to my old friends and all the people that I grew up with. And from that point on, I drank on Friday and Saturday nights. And Friday and Saturday night, within a very short period of time, became Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Then Thursday, because Thursday is the beginning of the weekend. You know, so Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then I have to drink on Monday because it's the end of the weekend. You know, so we got Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And Wednesday, that's hump day. You know. The only problem was with this, I don't identify with daily drinkers because it took me another 3 or 4 years to find an excuse for Tuesday. Yeah. I did. I came to New Jersey and Hartley's in North Arlington had a 50-cent mug night on Tuesday. So eventually I became a daily drinker. You know, I became a round-the-clock drinker, you know. But I also didn't believe myself powerless, you know. I believed myself an alcoholic, but I didn't understand what that meant, you know. I thought it was some kind of a reason for the way I drink or a badge, you know. It's like, I'm an alcoholic. That's why me and my buddy get a case of beer before we go to a keg party. You know, it's some kind of cool thing or some shit, you know. And I had no idea what it meant. You know, so for a long time, yeah, I said I was an alcoholic, but I didn't understand what powerless meant. I didn't understand that the booze was dictating it, you know, and that my warped brain was dictating it. You know, I thought I was having fun because I never tried to stop. You know, I was one of these people who never really tried to control it. You know, I just said, you know, why work when you can drink, you know? It made sense to me, you know. I like waking up in the morning and going down to the park, laying out my blanket, turning on my radio, and proceeding to party. You know, that's the way I lived, you know. So the whole job and the apartment and none of that stuff really, really made any sense to me. But fortunately, you know, they say that geographic cures don't work. For me, it did. For me, it did because it didn't work the way... It was planned, but it did work. Because I had to leave California. Because for me, the the lifestyle in California, it was too easy for me to do what I was doing. You know, I'm a local in a college town. I know where to get anything. You know, I don't have to work. I know all the places to crash where I can be safe, you know, and not have any problems. I know where to get food. I know how to drink. I'm fine. I could have stayed there forever, you know, or until I died, you know. I moved to the East Coast, and people here did something weird. They went to work, you know, and they had apartments, and they paid bills, and I didn't know how to function in that kind of society, and it didn't take very long for me to kind of bottom out. I wasn't able to live the type of lifestyle I was living. Fortunately, I found a girl who had a car accident settlement and $100,000 to blow. So that lasted me a little while. But it didn't last long enough. And in May of like 92, I guess, or 93, I was on parole. I had gotten like 2, maybe 3 dirty tests. I had gotten a shoplifting charge and a DWI. And so I'm like, oh, well, I'm in trouble. I go to my parole officer and I say, I need help. You know, I got to go to rehab. I got a problem. And deep down inside, I believed this. You know, I knew I had a problem. I just didn't really think it was the alcohol and the drugs, you know. Or I did, but I didn't, you know, and it was all twisted. So I ended up eventually making it into the Salvation Army, you know, after a long drawn out thing with the TC program that I wouldn't go into, and I ended up in the Sally, and one of the first things that was said to me, and it saved my life, was you got to get God to get sober. You got to get a higher power to get sober. And at that point, I'm a raging anti-Catholic, anti-religion, you know, I hated religion with a passion at that point. You know, I believed from the time I was in the third grade I was going to hell, you know, so I don't want nothing to do with this. But for some reason it registered, I gotta find God in order to get sober. And so what I did is I'm in the Salvation Army, and there was like 50 to 100 guys in there, or however many there was. And I walked from bunk to bunk, and I seen people that were reading spiritual books, reading literature. And I asked them what they believed. And I asked them what particular brand of religion they were prescribed to. And, you know, I asked them what it was about. And what I ended up doing was taking a piece from this one and a piece from that one and a piece from this one. And I put all the principles together and took away the deity. And the principles became my higher power at that point. And it gave me a starting place, you know. It says that if you're willing to believe, and at that point I was, you know, at that point I was pretty mangled. But and my mother's boyfriend or husband or whoever he was at the time started bringing me to meetings. And I started to see that there was other ways to live other than what I knew, you know. Because prior to coming to New Jersey, I thought it was perfectly normal to get married, have kids, smoke dope, grow old, hang out on the porch with a beer and a bong, and, you know, this is what a 70-year-old person does, you know. It was not abnormal. And here, people were doing something different. And I started to see that there was another way. My perception started to change a little bit. And I went to meetings, and everybody said, you gotta share about these reservations you got. You can't have any reservations. And I did. You know, I'm a stone cold pothead. You know, if everything else disappeared off the planet, I would have been cool smoking weed. And I never had any external problems as a result of it. And I shared about this, you know, and I shared about this, and I shared about this, and I shared my way right out the door because I constantly kept it fresh in my mind, you know. Nobody ever told me to share about it and get rid of it, you know. They just said, keep sharing about it. Well, I did. But the one thing that was said to me early on was, Don't drink and go to meetings. But if you do drink, go to a meeting anyway. You know, so I never stopped going to meetings. You know, I'd smoke dope in the morning and go to a meeting at night. You know, and I'd find people in the rooms that got high. You know, and we'd go out the back door and smoke a joint out back and come in for the meeting. You know, I did this for a good year and a half. And I'd share, you know. I've been around. I know the solutions. I know the answer. I know all the slogans and the catchphrases and all this shit. You know, what happened? My mind was so twisted at that point that I truly, honestly, give me a stack of Bibles, I'll swear to it, I didn't believe I relapsed. Because I have a desire not to drink. And pot is not a drug. It's a natural herb. God gave it to us. I'm going to be a Rastafarian, and I'm going to be spiritual. Okay? I'm going to go that route, and it'll work for me. You know? And I truly believe this at this point. You know? The guilt got me. You know? Because I guess I must have heard it somewhere that you're not supposed to smoke weed and go to meetings and share and, you know, and try and 12-step people. You know? But again, this perception on not relapsing was there. So I needed to go out and drink so that I could come back to the rooms and say, I'm coming back. You know, because I never relapsed. I never went out. You know, I kept going to meetings and I didn't pick up alcohol. I picked up booze and I couldn't put it down. I picked it up thinking, I'll go back tomorrow. I'll drink tonight and I'll come back and I'll say, I relapsed, I'm back. You know what? I couldn't get back. I could not put it down. For about 2 years, I went to meetings every single day, and I couldn't put together more than a week. Most of the time, it was about 2 days. You know, and the only way I can describe it is I felt like a hollowed-out egg, that if you touched me, I'd shatter. I'd just crumble to a million pieces. You know, that unmanageability was just so, it was vivid. It was vivid. I even tried writing an inventory at that point, you know, and maybe this will fix it, you know, because I didn't know anything about it. Nobody had ever told me to work the steps. They said, just keep coming back. Make 90 and 90. Get a home group. Get a bunch of phone numbers. Get a sponsor. Call your sponsor. Call your network. And I did all this stuff. I made probably 180, 200 and something meetings in 90 days. I was making a minimum of 3 meetings a day, sometimes 4. And still drinking. You know. Yeah, yuck. And they're telling me you don't want it bad enough. You know. You know, what do I got to do here? You know. So for 2 years, I was in and out and in and out. And I got to the point where I just stopped raising my hand. I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't raise my hand and say, I'm coming back. Even the last time that I got sober, I didn't raise my hand. I damn near didn't celebrate my 90 days because I wasn't sure. You know? It was an old guy. A guy named Bill Adams. He's died a few years back. Actually, died about 9 years ago. And he used to bring people up from Bayonne to the Kearney Candlelight Saturday night meeting, and he used to share about reading the big book to newcomers and dragging them off the street, putting them on his couch, reading the book to them. And I had no idea what he was talking about, because all the big book meetings I had ever been to and anything that was ever referred to the big book was a bunch of stories. You know, nobody ever pointed out that it was a text. Nobody ever said there was instructions. It was all about stories. And, you know, you read the book and you identify with the feelings and you identify with the jaywalker and, you know, that kind of stuff. And Bill used to say this, and it must have stuck with me, you know, because the last time that I came back, I picked that book up. And I opened it up and I started to read it, and it clicked. Something made sense for the first time in 2.5 years. Something made sense. There was some kind of hope in there. And to be honest, I don't know what it was. It was just something. It was a moment of clarity. It was a moment of seeing the truth. And at that particular point, I had no guidance. I told my sponsor I needed to write a four-step. And he goes, no, you're not ready for a four-step. You'll drink if you write a four-step. And I said, I've been coming here for 2 years, drinking every day. What the fuck does it matter? You know, what could it hurt me? What could it hurt me? You know, and I proceeded to break out a little memo notebook and carried it in my pocket for like 2.5 weeks, oozing and wanted to kill everybody in sight. And I had like 150, 180 resentments, you know, because for 2 weeks I'd write down names, and that's all I'd do is write down, I hate this one, I hate that one, I'm, you know. And what I would do at night is I was actually taking care of, I was house sitting for this guy, Mark. He was in rehab. And I offered to clean his house while he was in rehab, and I could crash there as a result of it till he got out. You know, I had to get rid of all the needles and all the stuff and everything, and I could crash at his house. And what I would do is I would review my day every night, and I'd look at where I screwed up, and I'd ask myself, am I willing to have God remove this? And I'd say, yeah, this one, yeah. This one, no. But this one, yeah, okay. God, please remove this. You know. So I was doing a 10-step. I was doing an 11-step. I was doing 6 and 7. I was doing it all ass backwards, but I was doing it. You know. In the middle of writing this really shabby inventory, and I bring this 3-column inventory because I seen the book and I looked at the picture, and I seen a 3-column inventory, so I wrote a 3-column inventory, and I brought this to my sponsor, and I start sharing it with him, and he's pointing stuff out to me, you know. And for the first time in my life, I wasn't the biggest piece of shit on the planet, and I wasn't a nice guy who drank too much, you know. I was somewhere in the middle, you know. I found some balance for the first time. I moved. Again, I've moved like 6 times since I've been sober, but I moved. It was my first year of recovery. Let me back up though. I was about, my first 2 months back, I wanted to drink all day, every day, 24/7, constantly. And I'm running to meetings, and I'm grabbing this new guy, and you know, my first sponsor did save my life. And the first, what he said to me is, I call him about some stuff that's going on in my life. I can't even remember what it was now, you know. And he's like, Adam, you know what to do. You've been around long enough. Grab a drunk. And I was like, but I only got 2 months. He goes, so? He goes, grab somebody with a month. You know, grab somebody with a day. Doesn't matter. At that moment, my house became AA Central. And some people can attest to this. It still is today. You know, it's never changed. From that moment, it has changed. It's gotten a little healthier. But in that first year, we had an amp set up in the living room. We had live music. You know, we were part of the Alcathon for Christmas in Kearney. We'd basically go to the meeting, grab the wet ones and the guys who were stinking and hungry and everything, bring them back to the house, give them a shower, feed them, bring them back to the meeting, you know. It was AA Central, you know, and the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. Anybody was allowed in our house, you know. Since my children have been born, we've kind of modified that rule a little bit, but back then that's the way it was. I didn't care if you were wet. As long as you wanted to get sober, you were allowed in my house, you know. And I've had some bad shit happen in my house, but you know what? It's all right, because it kept me alive. You know, but somewhere in about my first year or so, I got offered a job with the Board of Education in New York, and I didn't want to do it. You know, I do wood floors, and I love my job. And at that point, I was doing that, and I was learning the trade, and I was really digging it. And people are telling me, "Oh, you're crazy! You know, this is a union job. You got to take it. Blah blah blah. You know, benefits and the whole deal." And I was like, "All right, whatever. You know, I'll give it a shot." And this honesty thing that we're supposed to do here in this program kind of bit me in the ass, because I'm a convicted felon. And I was honest. And I made it to my 89 days of trial with the Board of Education, and then they fired me. And I'm trapped in Staten Island. It's funny because for the 3 months, or almost 3 months, I'm living in New Jersey, but staying in Staten Island at a friend's house during the week coming home. And we finally find an apartment. We get the U-Haul. And the night before we're supposed to leave, I get the call and say I'm fired. So I moved to Staten Island with no job, barely know anybody. And you know what? It was okay. It was okay because I knew something was going down. I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know I was going to get fired. But they ran my prints and they did my thing. And all. I knew this was coming down. And I was praying on a daily basis, God, please help me to accept whatever happens. Not what I want. You know, because what I wanted that particular moment was to keep my job, you know. But in reality, I was in a much better place by losing it. Because I ended up working with a guy in recovery over there. I got hooked up into the meetings over there. And I found a job doing floors. Taught me a whole new angle of the trade, you know. So when I did eventually come back to New Jersey, I was ahead of the game, you know. But I met some people over there that were doing house meetings, and they were doing big book studies out of their house, and I proceeded to go through the book with somebody, and we made it to about the third step, and he drank. So, but you know what? That doesn't matter, because what I did, what happened with that experience was I learned how to read this book. I learned how to transmit this information, you know, because prior to that, I was doing it all whichever way. You know, I didn't know how this book was intended to be done. I didn't know how the work was intended to be done. And I was doing the best I could, but I could have been more effective. And I learned that from this guy. And ultimately, when I came back to New Jersey, I was pretty much ostracized from my home group because they didn't want to hear about this sick hippie, you know, no shoe wearing, you know, tie-dye wearing, you know, freak walking into the meetings talking about God. You know, when, you know, just a year or two ago, I was, you know, in and out and in and out and in and out, and they couldn't help me. You know, I found a solution somewhere else. And it was right there in the meeting, but they didn't have it. And I walk in there, and plus I was also a rabid thumper, and which didn't help at all. But I was pretty much ostracized from this meeting. Nobody wanted to hear anything from me. You know, people were pushing newcomers away from me because they were saying, stay away from him, he's a fanatic, you know. So what I had to do, and I couldn't find, I didn't have anybody, no network of people to bounce my stuff off of, because every time I'd go with a problem, they'd say, oh, just keep coming back. It's like, I need a solution. I'm here to get a solution, not to hear keep coming back, you know. So what I did is I grabbed the sickest drunk in the room, and I brought him back to my house. And that's where it started. And I just went from meeting to meeting to meeting, finding the chronic relapsers, finding the people who could not get it. And I kept bringing them back to my house. And you know what? I don't think any of them are sober today. But I am. You know? And to be honest, I don't like that whole selfish angle of it. I really don't think that's a good thing. But you know what? It's true. It worked. You know? I wish they would have gotten sober. You know, I really wanted them to, and I wasn't doing it with that in mind to keep me sober. But I became involved in a clubhouse over in Clifton, and that's where I met Mike. Well, actually, right around that time, and we were trying to bring a message of recovery to this place, and. I don't know. I think clubhouses have a tendency to be breeding grounds for really, really, really bad therapy. You know, not all of them, but you know, the ones that I've been to can be really harsh. And this was one of them. You know, this was one of them. Nobody wanted to hear a solution. You know, we'd try and set up these workshops, and like three people would come. You know, it was horrible. So we set up the dances, You know, because that's, you got 300 coming to a dance. Three people come to a recovery workshop, 300 come to a dance. What are we going to do? But at this dance, I had the set-aside prayer posted to the wall, and just because it was a meeting house. And this girl, Meg, some of you know her, seen it. And she's like, I know that. And I was like, my ears jumped right up, because that's the Big Book Thumper secret handshake. It really is, you know. And I was like, wow, you know, somebody else who knows this, you know. And I was like, where'd you hear that? And she's like, oh, you got to go to this meeting. It's on Tuesday night. It's up in Bernardsville. And I was like, yeah, give me directions. Following Tuesday, I was there, you know, because I'd been running around the rooms of AA for 4 years, not having a fellowship, not having a home group, not having anybody that I could really, truly bounce shit off of. You know, I had a couple guys here and there, you know, spread around, but nobody that I could go to, you know, constantly. And I walk into this meeting, and I believe Cass was speaking. And I met the guy who became my sponsor at that point. And it was the first person I ever met that had any considerable time, you know, that was doing the steps. And it was amazing to me. It just, you know, it blew me away, because even the guys in Staten Island, none of them had more than 2 years, you know. And they were all the same as me. You know, we're all pretty much brand new at this, doing this deal. And I walk into this meeting, this guy's celebrating at the end of the month or something, 22 years or something. I was like, wow, cool. You know, somebody with life experience and the steps. You know, this is great. So I asked him to be my sponsor. And over the next couple years, you know, he helped me along this path. Fair warning to anybody new to the steps, because I made a really, really, really bad mistake. What this guy said to me was, he says, throw out everything you think you know, and we're going to start with something new, you know. And so I did, you know. Guy's got 22 years, and he's doing the steps, and okay, cool, you know. So I become this blank slate, you know, and it's like, feed me, you know. But what happened was, is I threw away all the good shit that I knew, and all the good stuff that was working for me for almost 5 years. You know, all the stuff that worked got thrown out along with the stuff that didn't. And what I was supposed to do was learn the new stuff and then incorporate the old stuff with the new stuff and find a balance and find out who I was instead of being a clone, you know. And it took me a lot of pain to realize that, because, you know, I went through a new process of the inventory, and I did another fifth step, and, you know, I did some sort of, I don't remember which exercise it was at the time, six and seven step. It was, I had unbelievable experience with the six and seventh step that year, or that one of those years in there. And I made amends for all that current stuff. And now I'm trying to live this deal, but I'm not feeling it. You know, I'm listening to everybody up at the podium, and they're all sounding great. And life is wonderful. Life is beautiful. And I feel like crap. You know, what's wrong with me? You know, what's wrong? And it was two things. One, I was judging everybody's, you know, judging my insides by everybody's outsides, you know, because people want to sound good up here, you know. And over the past couple of years, I've made it clear that I am not well, you know. You know, just for that new guy who hears this perfect friggin' message from the podium. We're human. You know, we have our bad days, we have our good days, we have our great days, we have our horrible days. Saturday was a friggin' horrible day for me. You know, we're human. But I started judging my recovery based on this. Plus, on the other side of it, I had thrown away a lot of good stuff, you know. A lot of stuff that was really beneficial to me. And what had happened is somewhere between here and here, it didn't connect. You know, and I'm going through the motions. I'm doing the work. I'm doing prayer and meditation on a daily basis. I'm going down the list. I got all the 12 questions, and I'm checking everything off, and I'm doing this shit by the numbers, and it ain't working. Something's wrong. You know, and what I came to realize was that I was relying on the process. I was dependent upon the steps. I was dependent upon the book. I was dependent upon, you know, I wasn't dependent upon God. Everything but God. And it damn near killed me. About three years ago, I guess it was. Was it about 3 years ago? Yeah. It was the end of August. The end of August, and I'm sitting in front of my computer, and my wife walks in, and she says, I want a divorce. And I was like, what? Where did this come from? I had no idea. I was totally clueless. I really was. I knew we were fighting, but I was clueless that it was like this. And I was like, holy shit, what just happened? And I proceeded to do a nightly review, and my sponsor came up. My wife came up, and something else. I don't remember what it was, but there was four names on this resentment inventory. So I figured I might as well go through the process here. And I went through another round through the steps. But it also at the time, you know, that open AA or that AA Central House, that evolved into a book study pretty much once a week for the past 8 years. And I was doing one at that time. And we were just starting it, and that first week I break out my book with all its highlighter notes and all the little dates on it, and, you know, after going to one of Bill's workshops with all the history, it's got to be exact, and I got to transmit the perfect message. You know what I said? Put that book aside, and I grabbed a brand new book. No marks in it whatsoever. I'm going to use this. You know. And I read this book. And I read it to the people that were in my house, and I talked about my week. And I talked about how this book works in my life this week. With all this shit going on in my life, with my life collapsing, you know, everything that I thought was important to me was just getting stripped away, and how this works. And it was the most powerful experience I've ever had in my life, you know, because it was new, it was alive, it was, you know, yeah, it's a textbook, but it's also more, you know. It's got a life of its own. You can read it one day and see one thing, and read it another day, and it's something totally different, you know. And it's just, it was. I just can't. It's hard to describe, you know. But by throwing away those highlighter notes and going with the blank pages, and I was able to be more honest. I was able to be more truthful, and more in the sense of experience, not in abstinence as opposed to experience. It was more about, it wasn't about the method anymore. It wasn't about the stuff. It was about the experience. And I went through the process. I had four resentments. I had like 28 fears, you know, based off four resentments. Yeah. And I thought I was okay just a couple weeks before. you know, I did my fifth step. I proceeded to make some amends. And something happened. I don't know. I got to this place where I went home one night. I was crashing at a friend of mine's house in Summit. And because me and my wife had separated at that point, and I was really pissed off at AA, and I didn't want to go back, and you know, because it was tough, because me and her, our lives were so intertwined, you know. It's like that's how I met Chris Raymer. It's because I called Chris to deal with this stuff, because there was nobody here that wasn't connected, you know. It was scary, and but I hated AA. I went home, and I got quiet, and I wanted to get out of this place, and all of a sudden this prayer came to mind. And it was, God, please help me to be unattached to that which I think I am. You know, I'm not attached to being a father. I'm not attached to being a husband. I'm not attached to being a sponsor. I'm not attached to being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. These are just roles I play on any given day. What I really am is a child of God. I have no idea where it came from. I know where it came. It came from God. But it didn't come, you know, it came off my pen. It was because I was open to it. You know, I was telling a guy tonight, he's trying to think his way through this unmanageability exercise. And I was like, dude, it's not about that. shut down the brain, let the pen flow, let God go through you and do this, you know, because this stuff ain't about the method, it's about the spirit, you know. And it's, when that prayer sunk into me, when that belief, and I started to practice that, all this stuff out here didn't matter so much anymore. Yeah, I was still concerned about it. I still wanted to get back with my wife, but you know what? If she didn't want to, okay. You know, I knew I was still going to be a father, you know. All those fears attached to, you know, all those fears attached to that weren't there anymore, you know. The AA thing, AA is going to do what it's going to do. I'm just a member, you know. I lost that. I got to fix everything. I got to change everything because I was no longer dependent upon how other people viewed me. You know, I wasn't dependent upon how I was dealing with these particular areas because all that mattered was me and God. And it was a very, very profound experience for me because I'm really up here way too often. You know, and I, at that moment or at that particular period of my life, I wasn't, you know, and I strive to get back there on a regular basis, you know, and I'm getting there. I do get there. I was probably there for like the past 2 minutes, you know, it's good, you know, I feel it, but, so was I sequential at all? Where am I at? My 10th step. I don't write. You know. If I have issue, I write. But on any given day, I don't always write. I stop. You know. If shit goes sideways during my day, I stop. I pause. I think out the fear inventory. You know, I don't sit and write it down, but I go through the fear inventory in my head. I ask God to remove the fear. If the fear continues, I call somebody. You know, if I've done harm, I try to make amends right then and there because I don't want to carry it over. I don't want to make amends anymore. You know, I'm tired of making amends. I review my day at night. I don't always sit down and write it out. I'd probably be a little better off if I did. It came up on my most current 4-step that I don't do that enough. But what I do find that is, if I have an issue during the course of my day, if it continues, you know, if it's here today and it's here tomorrow and it's here the next, I deal with it. I write it out. I go through the motions of the method, you know, because I go back to my basics. I go back to my roots. One of the things, though, I started last night or the night before. I started going back into the consistency. That's the word. It's not rigid. Yeah, you know, I need to get rid of that word rigid because I believe that the rigidity of it, for a long time, I believed the rigidity of the steps and the method that I used to know it was what caused it. I know it's not true. But the fear tells me it is, and so it keeps me from doing it. And the other day, the word consistency was substituted for rigidity, and I've started to come at this from a different angle. I'm starting to write out my stuff again. Meditation and prayer. I pray every day. I'm actually fortunate because I don't deal with people very often during the day. You know, I deal with customers and such, but I pretty much work in my head because I sand floors, I put on the headphones, and the world goes away. And what's left is me and God. You know, and I get to pray all day long. And some days I don't. You know, some days I crank up the tunes and I just put the little headphones inside my headphones. But when I'm not well, or when I am well, you know, when I'm not well and when I am well, I talk to God all day long, and it makes my day better. When I have any pressing decisions to make in my life, I use Oxford Group Meditation, because that's what I learned early on, and I know it works. You know, anytime I've made a major decision in my life, I've used the four absolutes. I've used the free flow writing exercise and the four absolutes and bouncing it off somebody, you know. Unless it came up four, you know, four out of four is great. And I've used that with every single major decision I've made over the past 10 years now. Actually, I learned it at 8 years. But the 12th step, carrying this message, I find that we live in an area that's actually, it's awesome, it's growing, it's changing, and it is starting to be receptive. But for my experience, I still have that baggage of being in the carny group and being told I'd drink if I did the steps, and you know, being labeled a fanatic and a Nazi and all kinds of shit like that. I left Bernardsville after about 3 years or so, and what I did was I went to nothing but quote-unquote fellowship-oriented meetings, you know, the don't drink and go to meetings kind of meetings, because in my mind at that time was, what am I doing? Am I preaching to the choir or am I carrying the message, you know? So I went back to the trenches. I went back where the people needed the message. You know, back where the people are saying, just don't drink and go to meetings, you'll be okay. You know, and I started carrying this message there. And in the first couple of weeks, you know, I got labeled a fanatic and a Nazi and a thumper and all. I had to step back. I was like, what am I doing here? You know, how can I carry this message to people who don't necessarily want to hear it? You know, they want the solution. But what you got to do is you go into a meeting and you don't use the word big book. Key. Number one, don't use the word big book. Use the word literature. The literature. You don't use the word steps. Use the word program or process. Okay? This is manipulation 101 here. I did this for 2 years. I went into quote-unquote dark tunnel meetings. I don't use that word very much anymore, but you know, so you know where I'm going. I went to these meetings constantly. And I tried to carry the message. And you know what? I was able to do that. I was able to carry the message there. You know, because I just eliminate a couple key words. Because as soon as somebody hears the word big book, they shut down. Because all of a sudden they've got all those ideas about me being a fanatic and a Nazi. Because I was. You know, I'm the guy who walked into the 12 and 12 meeting with my big book in my hand. We're on the second step, so I open up We Agnostics. And I start pointing out where they're doing it wrong. You know? I was a fanatic. I was a step Nazi, you know. I freely admit this, you know. But you know what? I was so on fire. I was so excited that I found this solution after damn near dying in the fellowship, you know. So I have to remember that, you know. I've helped create this. I've helped create this antagonism that the fellowship has towards me, you know. So what I do is I try to ease it in there, and they don't even know it, you know. I learned it from my wife. She used to do it all the time. I don't know how she did it, you know. She used to walk in there, she'd be all soft-spoken and bring them back to the house and then beat them over the head with the book. You know, it was... It's much more effective, you know. Take a kindly, tolerant view, you know. What I also found out over those couple of years is I don't need to give this message to everybody. There's people in the fellowship who are happy. Who am I to screw that? You know, who am I to mess with their stuff just because they're not doing it the way I think they should? You know, if he's happy, why mess with him? You know, if he's not, I'm more than willing to help. You know, I also learned that I had to speak about alcoholics like me, not alcoholics like you. You know, alcoholics like me, because I'm a twisted one. You know, I didn't drink for a long period of time, but when I drank, I did it to the extreme. You know, my role models were the winos under the bridge. That's who I aspired to be. You know, I used to see those commercials about the guy who said he never dreamed of being a dope fiend when he grew up. Well, I did. You know, these were the guys that I aspired to be like. You know, hey, they were 50, 60 years old. You know. They were alive. I thought I was going to die. You know, I'm amazed. I just had a birthday this week. You know, I never thought I'd live. I really didn't think I'd live. You know, I don't know how old I am, but... got to be like 35, right? Yeah. September 5th. My sobriety date is September 6th. And, yeah, it's an interesting month. No wonder I had a wacky Saturday, you know. All this stuff comes down all at once. And it's just back to carrying this message, you know. I'm a fundamentalist. I believe in what this book says, you know. For me. Maybe not for you. And that's what I need to remember, you know. I don't need to shove this down somebody's throat anymore, you know. I felt I needed 2 years ago, you know. Everybody's got to have this. Because you know what? I got to save AA, you know. I found that out in my fear inventories. AA is going to fall apart. And I'm not going to have nowhere to go if I don't shove this down somebody's throat and get everybody doing it right, you know. I'm that powerful? Yeah. Where's God in all this? Because that's what this is all about. And I like that, what you said. Is it about abstinence or spirit? Well, I've changed it today. Is it about the method or is it about the spirit? You know, because is it a living, breathing thing? Practicing these principles in all our affairs, real quick. How can I do that? There was a period in my recovery where I wasn't capable of making very many meetings at all. Very busy. I was doing side work. I had a day job. You know, I was doing all kinds of stuff. And what I found I needed to do was go back to what the original manuscript said. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and practice these principles. Well, what is this message? This message is not about not drinking. This is not a message about, you know, coming to AA meetings. This is a message of dependence and reliance upon God. And I can share that with anybody, if they'll listen, you know, if they want to hear it. So when I walk into a house and I go to sand your floors, if I see a meditation book in the bathroom, I'm going to bring it up over coffee, you know. I'm going to drop some lines. I'm going to drop some statements. I don't have to say I'm in AA, but I can talk about God. If I see a serenity prayer hanging from the wall, and I've done this. Because I can't make, at times I've not been able to make meetings. Where do I get my meeting? I got it having coffee with Mrs. Murphy while I'm doing her kitchen floor. You know? And you know what? It works. It works. Granted, it's much better to sit across a kitchen table with another drunk. But when one's not available, I can carry this message to anybody. You know? And I can live this program out there. You know? I'd much rather sound like an asshole in here and be good out there than to sound great in here and be an asshole out there. You know, that's just been my experience. And I want to thank you guys for having me here, and that's all I got.